BCFM Sports Saturday.
3:09.
It's been a close game. Chelsea look comfortable.
Bristol City have been very, very disappointed indeed. A very poor performance.
And here goes Calvin Williams with the Olympic torch.
Join Paul Davis and the team every Saturday from 3 p.m. on BCFM 93.2.
They have placed themselves in an elitist attitude to tell the rest of us what we need. And the truth is, we don't need them to do that. They haven't got the right to do that. They think they do, because they think we're just a bunch of stupid cattle. And I got to tell you, for the most part, most people prove them right all the time. Not intentionally, but because the knowledge, the truth has been withheld from the people. And that's how they manipulate people, is by withholding the truth and controlling them with the lies.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Harvey Proctor, Cliff Richard, under new data protection laws, is it becoming impossible for the press to tell us when they're being raided by the police? Mark Watts, he's the investigative journalist who arguably broke the story that led to the setting up of the National Inquiry into Institutionalised and Westminster Child Sexual Abuse, the so-called VIP Defile Inquiry. Yes, the National Inquiry is now on to its fourth chair, Alexis Jay, and apparently, as he explains, not being run by her, but by the Home Office lawyers from the very government department the inquiry is supposed to be investigating. Alexis Jay ran the Rotherham Inquiry, which decided not to prosecute police or social workers after 15 years of child sexual abuse in the city, mainly of children in local authority care homes. Thousands of crimes reported to police, but no prosecutions. Also, the exchange of fire between Iran and Israel after Trump pulled out of the JCPOA Iran agreement, we hear from Israeli Prime Minister's office. And MEK, the French-based terrorist group supported by Trump's new lawyer and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. It's like ISIS in Iraq and Syria, hell-bent on toppling the Iranian leadership. We find out why some terrorists are such good guys, we give them British taxpayers' money. Also in the House of Commons this week, on the same subject, the White Helmets, terrorist filmmakers and media medics get a robust defence from Prime Minister Theresa May. Maybe we'll start with that, Martin. The White Helmets, we did have a chat a couple of weeks ago to the daughter of the former ambassador to Egypt, Vanessa Bealey. Who are the White Helmets in Syria? We keep hearing about them on Channel 4 News, and what's their role been?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're essentially a front organisation for Al-Qaeda in Syria, and they're funded by the British government and the US government, and they operate only in Al-Qaeda-controlled areas, and in actual fact, they've got no medical or other training to rescue people at all. If you actually look at the videos that they film, professionals, medical and first responder professionals say, well, this is just it's just a load of amateurish stuff. So of course at Douma they walked into the hospital, shouted out chemical attack and started spraying people with water, but all the evidence coming out of Douma is that there was no chemical attack. They were just basically making it up. And previously, of course, they've been involved where there has been a chemical attack, but it hasn't been carried out by the government of Syria. It's been carried out by the Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda Syria.
It's almost like a Red Cross ambulance turning up and a whole bunch of guys getting out with machine guns.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's pictures of white helmet. The same people, the same personnel. One picture, they've got a white helmet on. The next picture, they're brandishing a Kalashnikov, because they are actually, and they were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British Army intelligence officer based in Turkey. and they've been turned into this so-called, you know, it's basically a front organisation for Al-Qaeda. And of course the Western Intelligence Service, the Turks and the Saudis, have been working with Al-Qaeda since the 1980s, and
well,
they're still working
as a result,
in Syria.
The American Congress has pulled the funding on the White Helmet. So let's have a listen to how that was put to Theresa May at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Matthew Pennicourt.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, despite the ever-present threat of death from both Syrian and Russian airstrikes, and in the face of smears and disinformation, the rescue workers of the White Helmets have never stopped saving the lives of their fellow Syrians. Last week, the Trump administration froze their US funding. With thousands of civilian lives at risk, will the Prime Minister step up, pledge the government to plug the funding shortfall that now exists, and ensure these heroic rescue workers can continue their work?
Yes. Prime Minister.
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman, we recognise the very important and valuable work that the White Helmets are doing. They are, as he says, doing this in horrendously difficult conditions. They are incredibly brave to be continuing that work. We do support them. We will continue to support them. And my right honourable friend, the International Development Secretary, will be looking at the level of that support in the future.
Well, what's interesting is that because of the information that's been put before the US Congress, that they are in fact a front organisation for Al-Qaeda, Trump has been forced to cut their funding. But the British, of course, are still funding and arming Al-Qaeda in... We're not just funding the White Helmets, of course. The SAS are based in Al-Tanf, and they're training these people to... what are Al-Qaeda? We've been working with Al-Qaeda since the 1980s, since Operation Cyclone. We're still working with Al-Qaeda. There is actually a real civil defence organisation.
So you're part of the smears and disinformation.
No, we're the ones telling. We're telling the truth about what's going on. Al-Nusra Front is Al-Qaeda, and the White Helmets only operate in areas where they are in control. And the personnel are there's actually personnel who cross over from being militants to being so-called helpers. Now, there is actually a proper civil defence organisation in Syria affiliated with the International Civil Defence Organisations, which actually does rescue people. They work mainly in government-controlled areas because they can't get into areas controlled by Al-Qaeda because the SAS are in there helping Al-Qaeda to bring the country to ruin.
So
of course, you've got tens of thousands of outside fighters from outside Syria who've been sent in by our military to fight the Syrian army.
This fight is taken to Iranian forces inside Syria and in Iran itself? Obviously, there's been terrorist attacks within Iran.
Yeah.
Just a few months ago, another attack on the Iranian government offices with a lot of people killed. What's going to happen as the this battle between Israel and Iran starts to grow in the next few weeks, months?
Well, it's very dangerous. Very dangerous indeed.
I mean, we've got American, British, French special forces in Syria. Yeah, Where will they be going? What will they be doing?
Well,
who will they be
at the moment, helping? What they're doing is retraining former ISIS militants to be infiltrated into the so-called SDF in northern Syria. And, of course, they've always been providing logistical and other support to the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists who are operating in other parts of Syria. And that is not something that started yesterday. The British armed forces set up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s.
I think it's
That's
time.
Why we've got the biggest number of Islamic militants in Europe based in this country, because we were the people that set all that up.
Well, before
and
we
we've
hear,
been still,
Martin,
we're still running it.
Martin, before we hear from the Israeli Prime Minister's office, let's have a listen to Professor Alexander Azad. He's this professor at Saddleback College in California, talking about this terrorist group MEK, which has been being supported for decades by the West, and their object is to kill as many people in the Iranian government as possible, and yet they're being supported by us, but particularly by the French.
Rudy Giuliani is a very, very nasty lawyer. He was the mayor of New York for quite a few years. He tore up New York. I mean, the people in New York are very liberal, very leftist. He tore that town down when it comes to politics. He regularly lectures in front of a terrorist group in Paris. They're called MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization. These are people who killed Americans in Iran before the revolution. And because they have a very strong lobby, they've been taken out of the terrorist list. Rudy Giuliani had a hand in that. John Bolton, the new NSA, National Security, had a hand in that. So he's not very young. He's getting higher in his age. He's getting up there. Nevertheless, if he does become a counsel for Donald Trump, and he was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump, and he was actually running for office, when Donald Trump was running. Then we are looking at a situation where Donald Trump is going to be bolstered. Having said that, most people are afraid of legal lawsuits, especially at the presidential level. Donald Trump is an expert, and he actually goads people into suing him so he can sue them back. So this is a shameless man, and he has shameless people around him, like Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, let me just put it, since you asked that question, let me just put it to you very briefly. This guy's only asset was 9/11. That was his political sort of cash cow. And so that's how he really ran the town after he was still the mayor of that town, before Bloomberg got in. But on the same token, we have to be fair and balanced. He really was tough on the mafia in New York. He did incredible renovation and closing down the ghettos, improving the ghetto situation in New York. At the same time, at the federal or national level, he's definitely going to be dangerous. He is instrumental in regime change in Iran. He should not be underestimated. And these people get, thousands of dollars for their speaking fees when they come to... By the way, the MKO is based in Paris. Why the Iranians have not negotiated or threatened Paris to expel these people is beyond me. It's absolutely beyond me. They're hosting a group of terrorists, and these are very well-funded. They have very strong lobbies at the EU in Brussels and also in Washington, but they are a proven terrorist group. They were also instrumental, MKO, or they also go by MEK, instrumental in suppressing the Iraqi people, because they decided to side with Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. They're political opportunists, and they put down the Kurdish rebellion after the 1990 war. They put down the Shia rebellion and after the 1990 war. And they're extremely nasty people.
Now,
and
okay, sorts of terrorists like MKO, MEK, where do they get their funding from? Who is pulling their strings?
The funding comes from, part of it comes from EU, a big chunk of it comes from Washington. And now, of course, if they're in France, I'm sure the French are supporting them. The French are using them as a leverage to negotiate with the Iranians. And the Iranians, I'm afraid, are falling for it. That should be one of the prerequisites. When Trump was on national air yesterday, or international air, accusing Iran of terrorism, it was, we all know the hypocrisy of Washington, but this was at the disgusting level, because they are supporting the nastiest the terrorists, in this case MEK or MKO.
Now, give us an example of what have MKO and MEK actually been up to over the years, and how long have they been active in Iran?
They've been acting since the 1960s in Iran. They were instrumental in overthrowing the Shah. They were actually with the revolution in the beginning, but very rapidly, because they wanted to take power and put their guy in power. His name was Masoud Rajavi. He got actually killed in Iraq. They had a military base in Iraq during Saddam Hussein war. It was called Ashraf military base, not too long from Baghdad. That totally got liquidified. I mean, they destroyed it. Iraq is destroyed. The Iranians destroyed it. A lot of those fighters there are all over Europe, especially in Sweden, Germany, and now France. These people started in the 60s. They started legitimately, even though they called themselves Islamic Marxists. And they fought against the Shah. They killed Americans. That's on record. But shift forward 40, 50 years into the future, their lobby is so strong in Washington that they somehow managed to take themselves out of the terrorist watch list or terrorist group or designated terrorist organization. And they have very strong lobbies in Washington. One of them is called the Iran Project, in which they have very strong influence over neocons like John McCain. He's the senior senator in Arizona. And then Lindsey Graham from North Carolina, these super neocon pro-Israel, pro-Zionist senators, and they're openly in league with the MKO.
What about the immediate problems after the revolution? And you say that MKO, MEK were actually involved at the time of the revolution, because I know that there were thousands of terrorist attacks in Iran. There was also the horrific attack which killed members of the cabinet and the president not long after the revolution. Was MKO and MEK involved in those?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's proven. I mean, they killed, they were involved in the killing of a prime minister and a president very early in 1982, if I'm correct, at the prime ministerial residence close to the Iranian, the former Iranian parliament location. They were and involved all the way down to the future. They, by the way, they cooperate very closely with Mossad. Mossad actually does the planning, MKO does the implementation. They were instrumental in murdering Iranian nuclear scientists very, very lately. Also, they were responsible and took credit for taking out Sayyad Shirazi, a high-ranking Iranian general who was also murdered by these people way after the end of Iran-Iraq war. So this is a very, very nasty group who's been active in terrorist operations during the Shah time and after Shah was toppled, when they couldn't get in power, when the Ayatollahs took over and they edged these Islamic Marxists out of power. And they're neither Islamic nor are they Marxist or communist or socialist. They are just a very shrewd, opportunistic group of traitors to their own homeland, which happens to be Iran. Now, a lot of them capitulated after United States attack and occupation, invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003. Many of the rank and file capitulated to the West. Many of them actually have been repatriated back to Iran. And they're very, very vocal all over YouTube describing how evil this organization was. Masoud Rajavi, who was the head of that organization, was a disgustingly corrupt man, having orgies in pools in the Ashraf military base. This has been well documented. This is a very evil man. His wife, Maryam Rajavi, who runs MKO right now in Paris, was actually ordered, Tony, he was ordered to divorce her husband and marry Rajavi. This is not just a political organization. It's also a very dangerous cult. The West has defined it as a cult, not just a political covert organization. And by the way, they have excellent organizational skills, which made them very, very dangerous. But their power is corroding. Even when they have, you know, morons like John Bolton or Rudy Giuliani at these huge conferences, which is, by the way, you can watch it on the YouTube, they don't have enough people to support them. So they actually bring people from Bulgaria and Eastern Europe, they drive them to buses to Paris in order to make their population look bigger in propaganda videos that they have.
Now, Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton, Martin, these are people who are very close now to Trump, and yet they're going along to these conferences of terrorists, the people who would do everything they can to kill the leaders of Iran.
Well, in actual fact, the thing about MEK, because of the history, they are Islamic Marxists. That's their official ideology. And you feel like saying to John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, so you support Marxists, do you? Armed Marxists. Islamist Marxists. And of course they do, even though they didn't, when they participated in the 1979 revolution, they were regarded as the enemy. But now, of course, they're being used as a cat's paw to try and undermine the current regime.
But the idea is that if these terrorists are wanting to overthrow a regime that we don't like, they're okay. If they're not doing that, then we're going to have to get rid of them.
Well, historically, they actually killed Americans before they became America's ally. A bit like Al Qaeda. They've got to get credibility.
So what's their role?
Like pretending,
Martin,
to kill
this,
the Americans, even though they're funded by the Americans.
As this conflict we're just about to hear the latest on between Iran and Israel starts to develop, I mean, it doesn't really seem like it seems like it's on a ratchet. It's not going to go anywhere but up. What's MEK's role going to be?
Well, they were originally based, as I understand it, in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but I think the current Iraqi government have kicked them out. So they haven't got a base.
Well,
they're
in Paris. They're based in Paris. They have rallies in Paris.
But they are the main people who carry out terrorist attacks inside Iran to try and destabilize the country. But in actual fact, their popular support in Iran is minuscule. They haven't got any popular support to speak of, and in actual fact, they're regarded as traitors, as they are.
Aren't they really just kind of special forces for the West?
Well, they've been trained by Western special forces.
So what's the difference between this terrorist group and actually being
the word terrorist, I don't care what we call it. We can call them terrorists if we like. They are. What happens in the West is that the sort of Gladio style in which things operate, they fund various kinds of terrorists. They fund Islamist terrorists. They fund Islamic Marxist terrorists. They fund anybody who will actually attack the enemies they want to see attacked. And of course, I believe you went to a conference about terrorism in Iran some while ago, and they were saying, well, we've had 17,000 civilians killed inside Iran in terrorist attacks. And of course, they openly boast that they've killed loads of Iranian nuclear scientists. And of course, the Iranians, you could argue, were within their rights to come and kill British nuclear scientists.
But
we're
actually,
gonna kill
what
nuclear scientists.
Who's operationally in control of MEK, MKO? It's the Israelis, and yet the funding is coming from the US and NATO.
Yeah, well, don't forget Mossad, CIA, MI6, it's all the same team, really. And their MEK are their little protégés, a bit like the White Helmets.
Anyway, let's go on to this exchange of fire in the Golan Heights and Syria. Martin, what do you make of that this week?
Well, we're being presented with a kind of, you know, you've got to work out what actually happened before you can comment. What seems to have happened, don't forget the Israelis have been bombing in, you know, inside Syria for ages. You know, they just fly in from Lebanon, or they do it from Lebanese airspace, and they attack the Syrian army, etc.
It's been happening for several months.
It's been happening for years, not for several months. I mean,
well,
they just keep doing
it. Intensifying
it. Yeah, they're intensifying it. And what actually happened, it wasn't Syrian Arab Army have said it wasn't the Iranians that fired into the Golan Heights. We fired at your stuff in the Golan Heights because we're getting fed up with you thinking that you can just attack us at will and we're not going to retaliate. But
nothing to do with the Americans pulling out of the JCPOA.
No, what we're talking about here is the Israelis have waited for them to pull out of the JCPOA because they want a war with Iran. They're pretty clear about it. And the British government had better make up their mind pretty quick because there's going to be a war with Iran, and we're either going to be in it or out of it. And I suggest that most British people don't want to be in it, but we're going to be in it anyway, and the Tories are going to drag us in.
Isn't the way of the Western powers often that they egg on other people to get involved in a war, but they don't want to
the Israelis want to start the war, but they want the Americans to finish it, and that presumably includes us. But do we want to go to war with Iran? People listening to this show, are you ready to go to war with Iran now? Do you hate them enough to go to war with them? For, of course, the other thing you've got to say, if you're going to go to war with Iran, what's your strategy? Because, of course, the Gulf is actually a killing field. A killing field. The Royal Navy ships in the Gulf will all be in Davy Jones' locker half an hour after the shooting starts.
And
if we run away to war with Iran, we need to think about that.
And what about oil?
Oil? Well, the Iranians, because of the sanctions on Iran that are coming back in, the oil price is starting to climb, which means, of course, the world economy is being pushed to the brink. But, of course, this is actually good news for Russia and Venezuela. So we'll see how it plays out. They shouldn't really... The problem with them is these people want a war, but they haven't got a strategy for winning it. And if it comes to war, they need to be given a very decisive bloody nose. Very decisive. And then we'll see. But, of course, the world economy will not take the shock. And that could lead... don't forget that if the economy collapses and the West is defeated in war, that's a revolutionary situation. The population won't stand for it.
Anyway, let's
have a listen. The population of the US, never mind the population of Britain.
Let's have a listen now to the spokesman for the Likud party and Netanyahu's office, the Israeli Prime Minister, David Keyes, now speaking on Channel 4 News with Jon Snow last night.
Well, it depends what Iran does going forward. It's now tried to move its forces about 1,000 miles west, right to Israel's border. In the early mornings, in the early hours of this morning, it shot dozens of missiles into Israel. We responded in kind. We hope the situation doesn't escalate. But Iran, for some time now, has been undertaking outrageous and aggressive provocations against Israel, lobbing missiles into Israel, supporting terrorist organizations that call for our annihilation, and, of course, speaking very openly about the fact that they seek nothing less than the destruction of Israel. We will not let that happen, which is precisely why we responded.
This missile attack, you say, that has occurred on Israel, where were the targets and what damage has been sustained?
Well, they lobbed 20 missiles towards Israel. Four of them were shot down by our defensive mechanisms, and the rest of them landed actually inside of Syrian territory.
But the response that you've meted out appears to be somewhat larger than the four missiles that you shot down and the other ones which landed in Syria anyway.
Well, Iran's aims are a lot bigger than four missiles as well. They've sent an awful lot of forces right to our border. They've tried to send advanced weaponry through Syria right to Israel's border. And they consistently call for our annihilation.
Right, let's just unpick this a little bit. The Iranian forces in Syria are largely there to support the Syrian government against the Al-Qaeda rebels supported by the West and Israel. The Israelis, there was a very interesting development this week. Hezbollah and its allies won the election in Lebanon. And of course, they are the democratically elected government of Lebanon. The Israelis claim their right to self-defense, but they won't negotiate with the Palestinians about anything. Now, the state of Israel is not necessarily a state that should be recognised by the United Nations. It was created in 1948 and it was given certain borders. They've never agreed to those borders. They've got an expansionist agenda. The Golan Heights actually belongs to Syria. So when they say we're being threatened and so on...
Well, ultimately, what he said was, Martin, what he said there was that the Iranians, and we're not sure if it was the Iranians, but anyway, they fired missiles towards Israel. So he's not actually saying that they were fired at Israel. Even he admits that it's occupied.
They were actually fired at Israeli positions in the Golan Heights. Yeah.
So they were fired towards
And they were fired by the Syrian Arab Army. The Syrian Arab Army said, no, we fired those missiles because we're sick of you bombing us. Now, if we're going to have a war... The question of whether the state of Israel should be allowed to exist in the borders which it claims, including, the Golan Heights, etc. And of course, Gaza is that border between Gaza and Israel isn't an international border. Those people inside Gaza used to live on the other side of the border in land which is now populated by Israeli settlers. Now, ultimately, if you're going to have a world war, then at the end of that world war, you might lose. And that's why people should think twice before they start it. And in actual fact, if it does come to a full-on fight between the Iranians and everybody else, the West and the Israelis, it's not clear that the West and Israel are going to win. If they want to have the war, they can have it, but they're not necessarily going to win. Now, the geography is all against them.
Now, next week,
not to mention the morality.
Between 6 and 8 p.m., we'll be having a special on the 9/11 attacks with an expert from the United States, Richard Gage, who runs something called and founded something called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, also the author we had here actually last September, Ian Henshaw. We'll be taking things on a bit and looking much more at the most important evidence that 9/11 wasn't necessarily the attack that we were told at the time, and that the inquiry was effectively a cover-up. Of course, Martin, this was an excuse for the war on terror, wasn't it?
Indeed. And underlying all of this, at the end of the world war we're probably going to have to endure now, let's hope that serious historians will write serious history.
Well,
it's pretty obvious that that was an inside job carried out by the US security forces, helped by Mossad. And that's what the historians will write.
Now, one of the interesting aspects of this is that Bush and Blair were prosecuted in Malaysia and found guilty, weren't they? And as were, I think it was Benjamin Netanyahu and Zippy Livni. So there are various people involved in war crimes that were a result of this war on terror. And Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has scored a historic victory just 2 days ago in the Malaysian general election. So he's back. The guy that did these prosecutions over in Malaysia is back in power.
Yeah, and the Malaysians also brought in exchange controls in the 1998 crisis, which the IMF told them not to do. So in many ways, the Malaysians are, they are regarded as a problem by the Western
powers.
They're
very close to the Singapore government, which is a sort of authoritarian socialist government, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a bit of tension there because the Malay nationalists and the Singaporean Chinese didn't necessarily get on. But at the same time, they represent an alternative pole of power. And I think it's very interesting that Mahathir Mohamad has come. He's going to release Anwar Ibrahim, who was his original protege and was regarded by the West as somebody to replace Mohamad with, and he's been in prison. But what he said is, I'm going to release him. I think that he's also been very sceptical of the 9/11 story. Of all the world
Which
leaders.
Will, as I say, we'll
and
be
he's just won an overwhelming victory
as I say,
in his own country.
We'll be discussing that next week. But now, back home to talk to Mark Watts, who's the investigative journalist who arguably broke the stories that led to the setting up of the National Inquiry into Institutionalised and Westminster Child Sexual Abuse, the so-called VIP Defile Inquiry.
My name is Mark Watts. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, former editor of Exero, which did a lot of pioneering work in the whole field of child sexual abuse reporting, for example, really sparked the overarching inquiry into child sexual abuse. At least that's what it initially was. It's become a little bit less overarching as time has gone on. And I'm still spending, I suppose, the majority of my time working in the field, mainly because so many people are coming forward to me, both in terms of abuse survivors who want to tell their stories, particularly when it relates to VIPs, but also whistleblowers, I suppose, especially former police officers.
Now, it's quite feasible that people might be coming to you, Mark, who are actually not been abused at all or know nothing about it, just simply to muddy the waters. Have you found that at all? And how do you tell the difference?
I think there are people out there who are certainly trying to do that, but I don't think they're really abuse survivors. I think that, for example, there are certain people within the police and in other agencies who are out there trying to muddy the waters and probably have succeeded in doing so.
Now, can you give us any examples of... Because, I mean, if the police are doing that sort of thing, that's pretty serious. Can you give us any examples of police that have done that?
There's a long history of that. I mean, there's a long history of dodgy police sources and sources, you know, in other in government departments who do exactly that. And I think one of the problems is that a lot of journalists rely on a single source, and especially if they have a source who on face value appears to be a very good source, they just run with what that apparently very good source has told them, regardless of whether there's any likelihood of any truth to it. And I mean, I think there is a problem here. I mean, I think as a journalist, I've often come across journalists who come to me, as it were, and pitch stories which are relying on a single source.
Exaro News was doing an incredible job a couple of years ago in really pushing this into the public domain in various ways. What's happened to Exaro?
Well, Exaro fell victim to a financial problem at the group that owned it called New Sparta. There was a financial crisis that had nothing to do with Exaro, except that the consequences of it had a lot to do with Exaro. So there was a sort of black hole that opened up in New Sparta Group. The group had to carry out an emergency review of all its various companies. And obviously Exaro at the time was not making a profit. It was making a loss in the order of a few £100,000 a year. And so in the context of the group wanting to stem the kind of hemorrhaging of any cash, obviously a company that was making that kind of loss was very vulnerable to being closed, and so they set about closing it for that reason.
Now, the whole business of child sex abuse has been covered by most of the major newspapers. There certainly appears to be plenty of column inches there. How easy is it to actually make money investigating child sexual abuse? I mean, is it financially viable, effectively, is what I'm saying?
I think if you're a freelance investigative journalist, it's quite difficult to make investigative journalism pay on any subject. I think probably what your question, focusing specifically on the issue of child sexual abuse, it is especially difficult now because of the sort of backlash there's been on the subject in the last sort of couple of years. I mean, when Exaro was running, we often worked with mainstream media outlets, and we worked with them on a whole array of stories, whether it be when we got hold of the secret Murdoch recording, when we found out about, you know, senior civil servants minimizing their tax by working off payroll. Often when we did these big stories that had a big impact, we would work with news television programs or with national newspapers. And the consistent thing with this is that the revenue we derived from those outlets would never cover the cost of carrying out the investigation concerned. So I suppose the direct answer to your question is that it's not profitable at all. And indeed, when we set up Exaro, we didn't even have, in the original business plan, the prospect of making revenue from editorial sales, if you like. Even in there was other lines of revenue which were down to the commercial side of the operation, none of which basically happened. But the editorial side was very successful, and as a consequence actually did make revenue which hadn't been particularly anticipated, although it came nowhere near covering the costs of the operation. So I think you probably would be aware that you know, investigative journalism is not a particularly well-paid thing. I mean, for someone who has the skills to be a successful investigative journalist, there are a lot more there's a lot more demand, if you like, for those people's services from outside the field of journalism than from within it.
You almost seem to be hinting there that the people who are trying to cover things up pay better than those that are publishing.
I wasn't meaning to hint that. Although Now you've said it, you're probably right. But what I was more thinking is, for example, I have a lot of friends who are investigative journalists who aren't really any longer investigative journalists and who work in, say, corporate investigations. So I don't do that myself, but I am commissioned from time to time to do investigative research projects for all sorts of things, but for non-journalistic parties, if you like. I find myself, doing a trawl at the National Archives on a specific subject, which no newspaper would pay for, because there isn't really the resource there for that kind of work. But there are plenty of other people who might commission you to do that work because they need it for a court case or whatever it may be.
Now, one of the problems is libel. If you say something about somebody, and I believe Harvey Proctor has just taken out a case against the Metropolitan Police because just simply for telling the public through the press that he was being investigated. Can you just take us briefly through some of the minefield of what the libel laws mean for someone who's trying to investigate a criminal who's actually prepared to sue just simply for mentioning their name?
As I understand it, his claim, which has only just been filed at the High Court against the Met, and indeed against the person who made the complaint that sparked the investigation, a person known by the pseudonym of Nick, I think it's a slightly broader claim for damages than simply defamation, although I do think defamation is part of it, but I think it's broader. And it's an interesting one because it's almost as if he seems to be saying that the police shouldn't have investigated him, had no business investigating him. There's another case that's a little bit more advanced, and I think everyone is watching with great interest in this field, which is Cliff Richard, who's obviously suing the BBC. And it's not a defamation action, actually, although, of course, defamation is part of his allegations against the BBC. The action is essentially a claim that they breached his privacy. Is kind of brought under data protection laws, and he's seeking very significant damages running into many hundreds of thousands of pounds, which is interesting because a libel case probably wouldn't generate that much by way of damages these days. It's pretty hard, I think, to win more than a couple of hundred thousand pounds, probably even a lot less than that. And fundamentally, he's saying that the BBC acted outrageously and breached his privacy and reduced his reputation by reporting the fact that a raid had been carried out on his property, even though the investigation subsequently didn't result in any charges or even in any arrest. Now, the BBC is saying, well, we have a right to report that this has happened. Nothing we reported breached the presumption of innocence. Now, we'll have to see what the decision in this case is. And I have already publicly predicted that whoever loses will, I think, appeal. So we'll have to wait for the outcome of the Court of Appeal decision, and who knows, it may go higher than that. But I think the real issues in the case come down to, is it a matter of public interest that the police are investigating a particular person, that they might have arrested someone? They didn't in this case. They didn't in the case of Harvey Proctor. But actually, Cliff Richard and in the case of Harvey Proctor, they did raid their properties. So does the media have a right to report such things? You know, should Britain become even more secretive than it already is and stop such reporting? But the other issue that will come into play with the Cliff Richard case is maybe it's not just a question of whether you can or can't report, but exactly how you do it. In other words, was it really appropriate to send up a helicopter and shoot through Cliff Richard's windows? Maybe the court will decide that that amounted to overkill. Even though the BBC, of course, resolutely says they feel it was entirely appropriate. In a way, at X-Ray, we were in a similar position because, of course, we made the decision to report on the fact that Harvey Proctor's house had been raided. And, of course, it's fairly common practice for newspapers to report on arrests or property raids. It may be that the investigation goes no further. Harvey Proctor's property was raided, he was interviewed under caution, but he wasn't arrested, and nothing was sent to the CPS for a charging decision.
Now, one person we can talk about until the cows come home is Gordon Anglesey, who is this senior policeman in North Wales. Can you just tell us about that case? Because I think it's pretty shocking that somebody can successfully shut down any press reporting on them and then afterwards be convicted as an abuser.
I think it's a really illuminating case. Back in 1994, as you say, he successfully sued for libel. The Independent Sunday, The Observer, HTV, and even Private Eye. He won £375,000 because of reports that imply that he was a paedophile. Various witnesses who claimed to have been sexually abused by him gave their evidence in court, and he won the case, which is, of course, only on the balance of probabilities, not beyond reasonable doubt, as it would be in a criminal case. It's only on the balance of probabilities. But even on the balance of probabilities, the media companies in that case could not establish the truth of the allegation. Now, shortly after that case, one of those witnesses was so traumatized by the fact that he had been attacked by Anglesey's lawyers in court and dismissed as a liar who was simply telling a story just for money, for, you know, for compensation or for some sort of monetary reward. He actually took his own life because he could not stand the fact that he'd been disbelieved. Now, fast forward many years, that was all back in 94, fast forward to November 2016, and that Gordon Anglesey, by now a former superintendent of North Wales Police, is being jailed for 12 years for having sexually abused two boys aged around 14 and 15. It was four charges in all of indecent assault against these two boys. So it turned out all those many years later that a criminal court deciding beyond reasonable doubt that Anglesey was, as those media companies had said all along back many years previous, was indeed a paedophile. And how dreadful to think about those witnesses who so bravely tried to tell their story back then, and one of them ended up hanging himself as a consequence of not being believed at the time. Now, Anglesey was jailed for 12 years, and just 6 weeks into his sentence, he died in prison. Well, actually in hospital. He had multiple organ failure, we learned from an inquest just recently. He was 79, so he was quite old, but he got well and truly found out in the end.
Now, there's a national inquiry going on. Really, a lot of this is into child sexual abuse. This is mostly being caused, really, by the exposure of Jimmy Savile, who had some very, very powerful contacts right at the very top of the British establishment. That national inquiry has had several chairs. The latest is Alexis Jay. The one before her was from New Zealand, but with very mysterious circumstances, without her really giving any explanation, she decided she didn't want to chair the inquiry and went back to New Zealand. I just wondered if you can give us some insight into why she left, and also how well is Alexis Jay doing in the National Inquiry, Mark?
Well, I think Lowell Goddard was having some problems in so far as she felt as though the Home Office really was controlling what she could do to a great an extent, which is a fundamental problem of this inquiry, which I don't think it will ever shake itself free from. And so much so that she was under the impression that she couldn't even appoint staff who she wanted to, and was obliged to have the sort of seconded Home Office civil servants who largely staff the inquiry.
Now, hang on, because that's a major problem, isn't it? Because you've got the Home Office actually being accused of being part of the conspiracy to cover up child sexual abuse.
Well, indeed. The original intention was that the inquiry would be overarching. It was ordered by Theresa May as Home Secretary in 2016, some years after Savile was exposed, and it was really as a result of actually reporting by Exero, and then a campaign by a group of cross-party group of MPs to get the inquiry instituted. And the original idea was that it would be overarching across the UK. And bit by bit, the people who were involved in the inquiry, the secretariat, the Home Office civil servants who've been seconded, together with the lawyers, kind of ensured that that overarching inquiry was curtailed. So I suppose the first thing was much of the UK was cut away from it. So Northern Ireland, which is in fact a very important part of the picture, was cut away. Scotland was cut away. The Channel Islands were cut away. So you were left with England and Wales. And I think the inquiry is going to do some useful work tackling child sexual abuse. There has been an interim report published in the past few weeks, which, in my view, made some very useful recommendations. But the thing that really sparked the inquiry was the prevalence of paedophiles operating in Westminster. And this is indeed one of the strands of the inquiry. Now, I think in this field, which is obviously peculiarly sensitive, there are all sorts of very powerful interest groups that do not want this to be fully or even slightly exposed. And I think the inquiry has shown itself to have been hugely constrained on this side of things. There was a preliminary hearing for the Westminster investigation back in January. And counsel to the inquiry, at least for this investigation, kind of set out what the scope of the Westminster investigation would be. And it does seem as though counsel is really running the inquiry rather than the panel, and there seems to be a problem with its constitution. I think the lawyers forget that they're there to advise. They kind of end up seeming to behave as if they're there running the show, and it looks like, in practice, that's exactly what they're doing. And the scope that was recommended by the lawyers for the Westminster investigation is hugely constrained. I have no doubt that when the panel announces its decision on the scope, which it will do in the next few weeks, I understand, I have no doubt that it will go along with what counsel said, namely to keep it highly limited. So I think the inquiry will do useful work on the subject, but I have my doubts as to whether it will really uncover anything in relation to Westminster. And if you take the example of Cyril Smith, it's already reached some conclusions in the Rochdale investigation, and it basically said in relation to Cyril Smith that the prosecutors missed opportunities to prosecute him. Well, that wasn't telling us anything we didn't already know. A senior CPS figure had years ago already put CPS's hands up, as it were, to having failed to prosecute Cyril Smith on three separate occasions when it should have done so. So the inquiry and its conclusions didn't add much to the picture there.
I think one of the biggest problems with child sexual abuse, I don't know if you agree, is this whole thing of a kind of double trauma. So when people are abused, obviously that is a trauma, but then when they try and get it dealt with through the police and through the courts, that can turn into another trauma, not just, you know, having to relive the experience, retell the experience, but then finding that the relationship with the police or whoever it is can actually become abusive and, you know, really difficult for them. And they were then left thinking, well, maybe I should never have gone to the police in the first place. So I wonder what you make of that. I mean, you mentioned the whole business with Gordon Anglesey and people who had tried to get him prosecuted, one of whom then killed themselves after what sounds like a miscarriage of justice. The same sort of thing happened with the Jimmy Savile case, where these various victims of Savile were interviewed by Liz McKean at Newsnight, and then she had to call them to say, well, I'm very sorry that even though I've interviewed you and you've had to go through that, I've been told by my editor that we can't run this story. So they would have been extremely upset that they've gone through this all apparently for nothing. So I wonder if we're getting anywhere with making sure that those who do decide that they're going to tell all about a horrific experience as a young person are actually well treated rather than abused again.
I think your point that abuse survivors often find themselves being re-traumatized by the failure of other institutions to investigate their allegations properly is absolutely correct. And just on Gordon Anglesey, one of the ironies was, I mean, I mentioned he was of North Wales Police, but one of the great ironies was that it was North Wales Police that were actually very keen, before the case in 2016, were actually very keen to prosecute him. They investigated him and they wanted him prosecuted. But the Crown Prosecution Service, that institution that time and time again has made mistakes in failing to prosecute people. I mentioned Cyril Smith. He's held his hand up to three failures on that one. Greville Janner, as he then was, later Lord Janner, a former Labour MP, the CPS held his hands up to failing to prosecute him on three separate occasions as well. And when it came to Gordon Anglesey, the CPS also refused to prosecute him previously, even though North Wales Police had investigated him and wanted him prosecuted, felt that the case was there. Of course, they eventually did prosecute him, and it was ultimately successful. So I think the CPS is a very important institution in failing abuse survivors. Certainly that's true in the past, and I think it's going on right now. The police, I think, is a mixed picture. Russia, I think it's really mixed. Clearly, there are examples of what you're talking about, where the police have behaved very poorly in investigating allegations and have effectively re-traumatized abuse survivors. But on the other hand, I do know of instances where that the opposite is the case. There are police officers who've done a terrific job in trying or in successfully investigating such cases. But you know what? I think the inquiry has to watch its behavior, because I think the inquiry is falling into the same trap. And I wouldn't be surprised, quite frankly, if in a few decades' time we have another inquiry which will have as part of its scope how this inquiry has treated abuse survivors so appallingly and effectively re-traumatized them.
Well, meanwhile, of course, many of the abusers have lived out their old age happily and have died without actually being prosecuted. But anyway, what advice have you got now for anybody who either themselves or they know someone, friends or family, who have been abused, Mark?
Well, it's an interesting one because, I mean, it does depend on the precise circumstances. I think generally, you know, I do encourage people to go to the police, although with great care, but I do encourage people to do that. I do encourage people to engage with the inquiry despite its obvious failings in public and some privately as well. So I encourage people to engage. I suppose what happened in practice with me is often it's people who are making allegations against prominent people where the police do not want to tackle it, or where other institutions have failed those people. Those are the people who tend to, as it were, come forward to me because they want something done about it. And quite often what I find is almost kind of doing a bit of personal advocacy, i.e. pointing to where they might go, where they might try to progress their cases. So I suppose the overall message I would have to people in that situation is to keep fighting.
What about Freemasonry? Do you think that's and it has played any role?
Well, I think in terms of what I've found is, I think it would be correct to say it has a role. So sometimes it plays a part in perhaps the abuse, but it also plays a part in literally squaring away the police. So it can be a rather useful instrument for a paedophile to ensure that they can get away with it if, for example, they or someone they're closely linked to is in the same lodge as a police officer who's in a position to pull some strings. So I think that kind of thing has happened. Witnesses who've come forward, and indeed police officers who have talked to me about investigations that were closed down, I think what the evidence from those people suggests is where it really comes into play is in literally squaring away investigations. So if an investigation needs to be closed down, it's one route, not the only route, but one route of achieving that end. Person A can simply ring up person B and say, can you do us a favour and just drop that case?
What about following what's been happening with the National Inquiry? Have you got any tips for places to keep an eye on this?
It's tricky at the moment because, you know, I don't think people can really believe a word of what they're reading in the newspapers about what's going on this issue, quite frankly. I tend to be following it quite closely, so people should certainly follow my Twitter feed, which will probably have a lot of key developments as and when they occur. But quite frankly, if people are interested in the subject, they're better off actually reading the transcripts of hearings of those investigations that they're particularly interested in. They're all available on the Inquiry's website. As an example of that, when the Cyril Smith hearings happened, the reporting of it was incredibly poor. There was quite a lot of interesting stuff that surfaced in the evidence, even if there wasn't much interesting in the final report. And it caused me to actually do a roundup of all the interesting evidence that had surfaced in the inquiry, which the media had pretty much managed to not notice. Those kind of articles I do publish on the FOIA Centre website. So I run something called the FOIA Centre, which is a specialist research company. FOIA stands for Freedom of Information Act. So we can go to foiacentre.com and look at the news section there. www.foiacentre.com. And I'm on Twitter @MarkWatts_1.
Mark Watts, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, some fascinating insight there, I think, and also particularly this idea of the new data laws allowing people like Harvey Proctor and Cliff Richard to sue the police and the press for invasions of privacy. Now, these are the sorts of private prosecutions that are actually only really open to rich people.
Indeed. I mean, if it was the case that everybody who is accused of a crime, it couldn't be reported until they'd been convicted, then you could say that that's one set of rules. But that's never been the case in this country. People accused of crimes are... It's reported that they've been accused of crimes. If they're poor people, they don't get any...
Yeah, there
buy.
Are rules for balance reporting if somebody has been...
that's right. You've got to say alleged and accused
if
and so on.
If someone is arrested, that's fine. You can report that. If they're charged, then there's rules come in. But what they're suggesting here is that Cliff Richard and Harvey Proctor shouldn't have been reported on. Anyway, we're also... part of this seems to be that the failure of legal aid as well, because there's a lawyer's strike going on. Apparently it's hit courts in Swindon this week. Mm. You might not care, says Gabby Hinscliffe in The Guardian, about striking lawyers, but you should, she says. We're already seeing the dreadful effects of legal underfunding as people are forced to defend themselves with only the vaguest idea of what they're doing. So at least lawyers are saying, well, actually, we want to represent people. We're not being allowed to.
Well, indeed, what will eventually happen, it's already happening, and it's in many ways it's been going on for a long time, is that poor people simply won't be properly defended, and therefore they're more likely to be convicted and so on and so forth.
Okay, finally, the undercover police inquiry. I mean, this is another inquiry. We just heard about what a disaster this national inquiry into child sexual abuse has turned into. The undercover policing inquiry. Apparently the report is now going to take at least 8 years, and that the judge in charge of the inquiry has been speaking to an empty court because the participants have boycotted it because they won't give them the names of the police involved.
Well, indeed. I mean, exactly. So these people, these police officers are being protected even though they carried out illegal acts. And that's not good enough, is it?
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon on dialectradio.co.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can comment at thisweek.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week for our 9/11 special. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It's an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.